Also, a weekly professor on TPC, teaching me about everything, nothing related, and it's all brilliant and wonderful. And I realized that last week we talked about the Buran and the Energia, and I forgot to ask if we could do that episode specifically. So you told me yesterday, like, let's do it, and I was like, oh fuck. So I apologize for putting that on your plate, but if we want to get
That's all
into
right.
it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm less of a space nerd than I am expert in some other things, but
Yeah.
I think I can hold my own talking about it. I mean, I did live through some of this stuff with
Yeah.
the N1 and the Energia and the Buran being discovered behind the Iron Curtain when the
Yeah.
Soviet Union fell and everyone going, what the hell?
Yeah.
So it's actually a whole related things. The Buran was like the tail end of a whole thing that started with the moon race on the Soviet side. And of course, all most people in the West know about that is that they lost rather badly. When they did lose, they ordered all of the remnant bits of the project to be destroyed. Kremlin was embarrassed by the outcome. And one of the things that was left over was a warehouse full of rocket engines that had been built for the N1. And like everything else, I mean, a lot of their technology wasn't known. We knew what they could launch and what they could blow up on the pad and all because you can't hide that. But we didn't know a lot of details about their technology.
Yeah.
So it was after the Soviet Union fell and Western investors were nosing around the old Soviet Union looking for stuff to invest in. And a guy literally found an engineer and said, "Psst, I got something to show you." And so he shows this guy a warehouse full of rocket engines that the Kremlin had ordered destroyed, but instead they had just hid them. And the thing about these were the NK-33 engines that had been built for the N1. And of course, a lot of people blamed them for the fact that all of the N1s they tried to fly blew up. But that wasn't the real problem. The real problem was that the N1 wasn't a very big engine, and so it needed 30 of them. And that meant that the plumbing was fragile and complicated. And so at least two of the four that blew up, they know blew up because the plumbing failed. They didn't have barge access to their launch site like NASA does in Florida, so they had to assemble the rocket on site. They never were able to fire the entire assembly of 30 engines in a test stand. And so they were finding out about all these weird vibration modes and fragile plumbing and occasionally exploding turbo pumps in flight. We melted a whole shitload of F1s figuring out how to make them stable, but we did that in test stands. We didn't do it 100,000 feet up with a stack on top of it. So it turns out that those engines were the most efficient rocket engines ever built. The Soviets had solved a problem that Western rocket scientists had decided was unsolvable.
What's that?
Okay, well, a certain amount of the energy that comes from the fuel has to be used to pump the rest of the fuel into the combustion chamber. And the higher the pressure in the combustion chamber, the more efficient the rocket is. The F1 engine had a chamber pressure of 80 atmospheres. In the modern RD-180, which is descended from the NK-33, it's like 270. And it takes a lot of energy to do that. So what they do is they siphon off some of the fuel and use it to run a turbo pump, which pumps the rest of the fuel into the combustion chamber. So yeah, see, conceptually, a rocket engine is a real simple thing. It's a chamber with a hole in one side and a nozzle in the other, and you spray fuel in this end and fire comes out the other.
Yes.
But God is in the details, and once you start figuring out how to do that with without blowing up the neighborhood, things get interesting.
Yeah.
So
Tyranny, right?
in all of the
I said tyranny, right? The tyranny of the rocket. Isn't that one of them?
I'm not familiar with
The
that one.
tyranny of the rocket equation?
Oh, yeah. You have the specific impulse and all that.
Yeah, you have to use fuel to lift fuel. But now I'm also thinking you got to use fuel to lift fuel, but also use fuel to pump fuel. And it's like,
yeah. Well, and that's it. You use about 10% of your fuel to pump fuel. And another thing that you have to do is, in order to not melt the turbine, they run American rocket engines run a very lean mix. They run a lot less oxygen than the fuel needs, so the unburned fuel keeps things from getting too hot.
Okay. So
because otherwise the bearings would fail, the pumps would explode. So you have this very unbalanced mixture, and what they do with it in the F1 and the space shuttle engine and all the rest of the American made engines ever made is they toss it overboard. They just pump it into the bell and it goes out the bottom. It doesn't contribute to the thrust. What the Russians figured out was how to take that wasted fuel and put it back into the combustion chamber and burn it. And the neatness about that trick is it's very hard to do without blowing the engine up, because it's hard enough to make the engine stable when you're not pulling this trick.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a problem. The other thing that the Russians did is, instead of running a lean mix like the Americans did, they figured out how to run instead of running a rich mix, we run too much fuel.
Mm-hmm.
They figured out how to run a lean mix with too much oxygen. And that actually makes for better thermodynamics and for more efficiency, but it also results in all this very hot oxygen coming out of the turbo pump chamber and having to be piped. And of course, hot oxygen doesn't agree well with metal. So figuring out how to keep it from corroding the engine to nothing in a few minutes was a major obstacle. The Russians solved that. They got the metallurgy in place. They figured out how to design the combustion chamber so that it was stable. And they did all of this without by doing it theoretically. They had a guy who apparently just had a rocket chamber in his head and just could visualize all of these dynamical flows.
Mm-hmm.
It's been said often that's one of the differences between American designers and Russian designers is the Russians will figure out all of the mathematical theory behind a thing. The Americans will just build a computer and use numerical methods. And
I've had on several times Garrett Bruhaug, who's I think a little older than me, but is getting a degree in nuclear fusion and works at the Laboratory of Laser Energetics at University of Rochester. He's brilliant. He comes on here all the time. But the last episode we did, we were talking about like asteroid deflection and KGB versus CIA, Soviets versus America. But that's what he said. He goes, the Russians, because like the Soviets never were just flush with cash like we were, we were just like, fuck it, just space agent, right? Just give it a hard drive. He was like, they always figured out these beautiful, eloquent mathematical solutions to things. So it's interesting to hear him say that and hear you say that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a trope. So anyway, most people don't realize that the United States has been buying rocket engines from Russia since 2000.
What?
Most of our larger loads have been lifted on Soviet-made RD-180 rocket engines for most of the last 20 years.
Yeah, I learned.
Because they're more efficient. If you can get an engine that's 5 or 10 more efficient, more percent efficient, then you know that 14 pounds of fuel to put 1 pound in orbit, that's a huge win.
Yeah.
And so now as part of that deal that they inked when we started buying engines from them, that first contract, the Americans insisted that we get their technology. There was like 10 critical technologies that we didn't have that were without which you couldn't build the engines. And they insisted that they turn over all the documentation to us so that if we needed to, we could build our own engines. And they didn't want to do that. That was like a hard ask. You know, that was a big ask. But they were also broke. They were completely out of money. And so they swallowed hard and gave it to us.
What a funny American trope. Now it's whenever a country falls, we go in and we get shit related to rockets, right? Two times now. What's the third going to be? China? Are we going to do it with them? It's God willing, but Or vice versa.
The thing is, the Russians have always been a lot better at things than people realize, because they don't have our natural resources. The fact that they've done as much as they have is just mind-blowing.
The fact that they got Sputnik up before is...
Sputnik?
Yeah.
And the atomic bomb.
Yeah, in 49.
You got to figure, by the time we detonated Mike, they had pretty much plugged all of the leaks as far as spies and shit. So all the Soviets knew was that we got 10 megatons. They didn't know how. But that's all Sakharov needed.
Yeah.
Once he knew that 10 megatons was possible, he went out and figured out how to do it. You know,
the fact that they had men in the Manhattan Project, in like the village that was like guarded by like razor wire and guard towers. People don't know that, but like the actual, like the scientists, we corralled them into a village surrounded by like the military, because we were like
in the middle of the desert.
Yeah. Did you know they used to have a little theater, and they would all do plays. Oppenheimer loved like acting in plays. Yeah. Actually, yeah, I think that's in one of Richard Rhodes' books, but
it's in Making of.
Yes.
There's a plate of all of them acting out, and they're like acting out the scene with the Trinity explosion, and they're using a stepladder as the Trinity Tower. They're like doing little pyrotechnic things and stuff.
But they
had to be their own entertainment.
But the fact that they had men in there, that's insane.
Well, that's the other thing, is that the Soviet spies were very dedicated.
Yeah.
And because they knew what a disadvantage they were at, that they had to be willing to do anything, whatever it takes.
Yeah. Anyway, I was interrupting you. Back to it.
Oh, no, that's all right. But besides, Mitzi said I'm not supposed to monologue.
Monologue. that is a new rule. Yeah. That's true. You have to ask permission. As I explained to Mitzi, I love when people monologue, because if they don't, I do. And I already have my internal monologue every day. I don't need to hear it more. The podcast ends when I stop recording for everyone else, but it continues in my head. And then it just goes to the next, and I start recording again. The insanity doesn't stop. So, Roger, please monologue.
So anyway, we've been buying rocket engines from the Soviet Union for some of our most critical payloads, including military payloads, ever since the first Antares in the year 2000. And around 2015, some of our people started to get a little nervous about it, because you started to have the mess in Crimea, and relations were getting a little cold, and eventually, the Soviet government asked us to stop using their engines to lift military payloads, and so we started looking seriously at alternatives. But we didn't have an engine that could compete. When we launched the shuttle, we told everyone that the shuttle main engine was the most efficient rocket engine that had ever been built. It was actually the second. We just didn't know it at the time. They had one company that took a stab at duplicating them, and their quality control wasn't up to it, and they had an explosion.
How the hell did we not have our quality control up to that of Soviet quality control? How did we not? I guess that just means that I have
I work in industry. You have no idea.
Yeah. Well, and I guess that's also a slight to the Soviets, because clearly they did it. So who am I to sit here and cast shade at? They did it.
Yeah. Well, one of the things is that when they do something, they don't stop doing it and start with a blank piece of paper to do the next thing. They tend to use what they had before as a starting point. I mean, they've been making Soyuz capsules since the 70s.
Yeah.
That's their design. Yeah. They've improved it incrementally, but it's like those people that are building Soyuz capsules know exactly what they got to do. There's no mystery to them. It's like they're line operators at a Ford plant.
Yeah. it's like a fine craft, right? Yeah. It's like leather making or something.
So anyway, there's actually a little contest going on right now to see who's going to replace the RD-180. And it really involves replacing the entire first stage booster, because so much of, those rockets we're using to fly the RD-180 were designed to fly the RD-180. So you can't just say, well, we're going to bolt a different motor on it. I mean, suppose it uses methane as a fuel instead of kerosene, which is, I think, both SpaceX and Blue Origin are doing. So as usual, though, my money is on SpaceX. When SpaceX is in it, your money should always be on SpaceX.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, so the they are actually, their Merlin engine, apparently, I'm kind of fuzzy on the details, but apparently it uses both a fuel-rich and an oxygen-rich stream in different places. So somehow that's better when it gets back into the combustion chamber and they recombine them or something. But, you know, they're basically saying, well, it's like, we're not going to duplicate this thing. We're going to do better.
Yeah.
And, that's... I mean, let's face it, that's the attitude.
Did you know that in the book Space Barons, by which you would love, by the way, you would love Space Barons by Christian Davenport. You would love it. It's about Bezos and Musk. But just short aside, early on, like early in the 2000s, when Elon wanted to sort of like make some waves about SpaceX, he did like a publicity stunt. I never knew this. But apparently he put one of the rockets on like a flatbed and just like had it driven into DC and then just like stood around it and like basically like, this is my ride. And just and everyone was like, who the hell is this guy? And it was a young Elon Musk, like, you know, this is my rocket. It's a rocket. It's going to be big. We're going to be the best. And they were like, this is only a piece of a rocket. He's like, it's going to be like 10 times bigger. And they were like, who the fuck is this guy with, like, is this a security threat? And now he's fucking Elon Musk. But
yeah,
I'll send you a link to the book Space Barons by Christian Davenport.
Yeah. Yeah, do that. Okay,
yeah,
so so anyway, Buran was, you know, obviously their answer to the space shuttle. And they had the advantage of watching us do our shuttle first, but they did several things differently. And most of the people who have been watching it agree at this point that most of the decisions they made were better than the ones we made, which has a lot to do with the fact that they saw us first. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always easier to watch someone else make the mistakes. So the critical differences, big number one, of course, liquid fuel boosters. None of this solid rocket bullshit. And the funny thing about that is that the shuttle was supposed to have liquid fuel boosters in the original design, but they were supposed to fly home for reuse, but they got budgeted out because Congress wouldn't give them enough money, and so they cheaped out. But the Russians actually built liquid boosters. Okay. And that's partly because they used a big dumb booster instead of an external fuel tank and put the motors on the booster instead of on the shuttle. Mm-hmm. And that has the advantage that when the shuttle gets to orbit, you're not carrying all those thousands of pounds of dead weight that don't do you any good anymore because you're in orbit now. And so they were just like, the economics of it say, no, throw the engines away. It's not that important to save the engines when you look at the total economics of a launch. Yeah. So, of course, they hadn't had Elon Musk to come along and say, hold my beer, and not only not take the engines to orbit, but save them and get them back anyway, you know.
Fuck it, land it.
So the technology of the 70s and 80s probably wasn't up to that. But that's definitely the most elegant solution. You know, so you not only get the engines, you get the whole first stage back, and the orbiter or whatever you put in orbit doesn't have all these heavy engines hanging off the back end. They also built their shuttle to be completely remote controllable from the ground up. Mm-hmm. And that made it more versatile in a lot of ways. Obviously, the one test flight that they ever did was by remote control. They didn't need to risk a crew to do it. Whereas when we sent the thing up, if half the tiles fell off and it burned up on reentry, we had two guys on that thing who were toast.
Yeah.
So that, fortunately, it worked out. Less fortunately, a little later. They also saw the falling off tiles. They knew not to go that route from the outset. But a lot of the stuff they did was similar. The guy who designed it, I never remember any of these people's names, so you can look it up. The government of the Kremlin gave him the latitude to build whatever he wanted. What they saw was that the shuttle was a military weapon, mm-hmm. and they wanted to have a counter to it. They saw it as a tool for putting military payloads in orbit, and they didn't have an answer to it. So that was the thing, is that they needed something that was an answer to the shuttle. Now, just like us, they also saw that it could be used to put up bits and pieces of space stations and to do service on satellites and stuff like that, which is all cool. But the reason that they funded it before they all fell and ran out of money was so that they would have a counter to this technology the U.S. would have, primarily for military purposes. Mm-hmm. Now, a difference, though, is that the Soviets didn't contemplate throwing away their disposable rocket program. They never saw a future where they wouldn't be making disposable rockets. To them, that was a technology that would continue because it made more sense for a lot of situations. So when their shuttle program got scrapped, it was no big deal. That's one of the reasons they were able to scrap it so easily when there was no more money, was they weren't using it for anything that they desperately needed anyway. Whereas America bought heavily into this fairy tale that the shuttle was a space truck.
Yeah.
That it was a general purpose, you know, just like a car or a truck. Well, it was supposed to be like a space car. Then it had to become a space truck because of the military guys needing to lift those payloads.
Yeah.
Basically, the whole shuttle was designed around keyhole satellites.
Yeah.
Which are basically Hubble Space Telescopes that point down instead of up.
Yeah.
So it had to be big enough to loft one of those. And that was not really what NASA originally wanted. You know, but they were putting so much money into it that it had to be like the lead thing in the game. I know there were guys at NASA in the early 70s who really favored an approach where there would be a space plane that would mainly be to take the crew to orbit, but that would be roomier and more capable than a capsule like the Apollo capsule. But that would require us to still be making disposable rockets. And there was another faction that was driven by the philosophy that we are going to the future where there will be no disposable rockets. We will reuse these rockets. We'll have 100 launches a year. They found out if they had ever had 100 launches a year, the ozone layer would have completely gone away.
But Jesus Christ.
Every time they had a launch, it put a big hole in the ozone layer over the launch site.
Jesus Christ. I didn't know that. Yeah, the Rockwell space plane, it was designed in like the 70s or 80s. I can't remember the name of it. It's the Rockwell something.
Yeah. Well, they got that. And also that cute little lawn dart that the Air Force launches every once in a while that I forget what the designation is supposed to be. It's supposed to be secret, but it's like everyone can see.
Oh, the XP-37?
Yeah. It's a teeny little shuttle on the nose of a rocket. So.
No, the Rockwell space plane was like far bigger than a 747. They never got off the drawing board, but would have been awesome.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was kind of the original idea, was to have a self-supporting way that was more like an airplane to take the crew and to do delicate stuff that had to be handled by human beings and so forth. But it just grew and grew and grew until it had to do everything, and so it doesn't do anything very well.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviets wanted it for that that heavy purpose. They wanted a counter to the shuttle for the military apps, but they never saw it as completely replacing their rocket, the rest of their rocket program. So in some ways that was why they didn't care so much about saving the engines. They didn't contemplate this fantasy of doing 100 launches a year. Mm-hmm. They wanted it for that launch that they couldn't do to match something that we were doing. And it also had the advantage that they could just ditch the orbiter entirely and put something else on the Energia stack, like a component of a space station or something in a fairing. They didn't need the human crew. That was the other thing, is if it's a space plane or a space truck, it has to have a driver. Mm-hmm. And so we never really thought about the possibility of just launching it without a crew and controlling it from the ground, even though that's how all of our other rockets worked. We literally didn't want the shuttle to work that way. So the Soviets had a much more versatile type of, you know, their vehicle could do things that the shuttle was not literally never designed to do, some of which could have been very useful. Of course, in the late 80s, the country fell, they completely ran out of money, and they started selling us rocket engines and shit because... what else are you going to do? They actually didn't start selling us rocket engines for about 10 years. I think they sold us the first one around 2000.
Okay.
But there is a story where they showed this guy the warehouse and they got into some negotiations, and then they were like, they had the specifications and all, and they're like, this does what? This isn't the number, because the numbers were better than anything any of our engines put up.
Yeah.
So they ended up buying 30 of them, and they put one on a test stand out in California, and it met its specifications. So it was like, damn, we need to design a rocket for these things.
Yeah. So it was, but you said they did eventually give up the designs.
Well, they gave up the designs and the stuff. But well, one of the things about it is that the factory where they're made has its own forge, its own metallurgy. It does. They start with raw materials, make their own metal, their own alloys, and it's all like in one building.
Jesus.
And they start from first principles all over the place, and then rocket engines come out the other end. So duplicating this facility. It's not just like building a normal plant,
yeah.
Like like Michoud over in East New Orleans or something. This is a place that they're doing like the whole thing from soup to nuts, and it's all together. That's one of the reasons their quality control didn't have. They weren't like accepting products from someone else that said they were meeting the specification, but maybe they were, maybe they weren't. So you've got, they knew where this metal came from. It came from down the hallway down there.
Yeah.
So they
showed up with train cars of ore and then rocket engines pumped out.
That's pretty much it.
The original 3D printer.
Yeah.
just dump in shit, magic comes out.
So that was one of the reasons that we never really duplicated their works, was because it would have cost a shitload of money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that's one of those things where if you look at the economics, they wanted to know that they could if they needed to. So they insisted on getting the technology, but what they got was the specifications and the recipes and everything. But we never actually built the whole thing, because it was just cheaper and easier to pay the guys who were already tooled up and knew what they were doing to do their shit, rather than figuring out how to do it ourselves and putting something that complex together. Especially when you're looking at it, it's still a 40-year-old technology. So even though it was ahead of everybody else's, and this is the metric by which rocket engine designers measured themselves against ever since 1990 or so.
The RD-180? The RD-180?
Yeah. This was still the... the RD-180 was like the end result. There's like a whole family of engines that use this technology.
Sure.
But yeah, the basic thing is they started with these engines that were left over from the Russian moon program and updated them and modified them and... scaled them differently and all, but it was basically using that technology. But again, the people who originally had done it in the first place were in the best position to do it again. So we never really tooled up to do it ourselves the same way, because we had access to the guys who already knew what they were doing and had everything in place. That only became an issue about 5 years ago, when stuff, things started to deteriorate between us and the Russians. So now they're like, oh shit, we got to do something. And like I said, it might be Blue Origin, but my money is always on SpaceX.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Blue Origin, I'm not even going to go into it. You have to read Space Barons, because we need to do a whole episode on that.
Yeah, well, I need to get a copy of the book then. So.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. I'll email. I think I might be able to send you a copy, because I've bought it and listened to it. I think I can give you a copy. It's on for Audible, at least. I can't read. I don't know how to read. So it's but on Audible, at least. But
well, I have a 45-minute each way commute, so that works.
Okay, yeah, then dude, it is. I listen to a lot of audiobooks, dude. It's premium. It's solid. But yeah, I was going to go into Blue Origin, but no, we're going to save that for another episode. But sorry. But yeah. It's now, is the Merlin or the Raptor engine for SpaceX?
Both of them are. I think one of them is the engine they're using now, And one of them is the engine that they want to put on Starship. And that's the one that is supposed to be more efficient than the RD-180, using this advanced technology to reuse the fuel and all. But one thing they did, I think they're using methane as fuel instead of kerosene. Well, right there, that changes the whole design of the rocket that sits on top of it. So you can't just bolt that engine up on a rocket that was designed for an RD-180 and expect it to work.
Yeah,
so
dump out the Coke and put in Sprite. It's not the same. There's a reason it's called rocket science, right?
Yeah. So that's kind of going on in the background, even as we speak. So yeah. that's hasn't been resolved what's going to happen in the future with it. But Congress basically stepped in a year or two ago and passed a law that said, okay, no more Soviet rocket engines. We'll give you till 2022 to come up with something else. But then you got to stop buying Soviet rocket
engines. Get off the Soviet teat.
That's one of the reasons these programs are going on, is Congress basically told them enough is enough. And I'm sure there was a certain degree of political embarrassment over it too when it was discovered.
Not only that, man, you gotta think of like constituent districts and shit. If we're buying these, we're not producing defense contractor X in my home state, right?
Right.
So that's a
well, and plus that, well, and let's face it, exceptionalism has always driven the space program in every country that has a serious space program. Mm-hmm. It's part of the national dick waving contest. And the fact that you're buying engines from your competitor there is like,
it's a total beta move to, like, the fact that we have to hitch rides on the Soyuz for several years.
Yeah, that is sand in the Vaseline, man.
It is. It is. I love the meme. That was like, it was like 1969 to, when was the space shuttle retired? 2011?
Yeah, somewhere in that area.
We'll call it 2010, whatever. It's 1969 to 2010. It's space flight, like USA, USA. From 2010 to summer 2020, and it shows it's 1969 to 2010, Americans. Yeah. Space flight is USA. Americans 2010 to summer 2020. Guys, there are no borders in space. We're one people. We're all going to orbit. Let's drop the nationalism. Yeah. And then it's the date that we launched the guys from SpaceX. And it's all about cooperation. And get fucked, USA, USA. It's hold it. We still need the Soyuz, all right? This is a group effort. It's a group effort. Yeah. American rockets from American soil. And then they're like, and if something fucks up, it's going to be, guys, we're all one species, all right? just the American, just two-faced.
That says a lot, doesn't it?
But you're right. It's exceptionalism, and it's, I mean, hell, there's on some cases we see where it's not so good, but I think there is healthy ego. I do think that there's healthy ego, like competition, and I think, I mean, to an extent, when the dick waving turns into ICBM waving, that's a problem. But when it's just if we can keep it in just space race, I think everyone benefits. Like, I think the best thing that could happen would be for the Soviets or the CCP to come out with their own space force. I think that's the best thing that could happen.
Yeah, well, there's some question as to whether the engine works that makes the RD-180 is going to survive, because they've made 90% of their money selling engines to the West. And if that comes to an end, then, you know, because Russia is still mostly capitalist now. So, you know, there's no more government supporting the means of production. They got to make money or they shutter the place.
Start selling to China, maybe.
Well, China is more interested in having their own capability. If you look at them, they're not as worried about being number two as they are about being shut out of the game. It's why they never participated. They worked very hard to get a few ICBMs, but then they only built a few of them. They built enough to seriously ruin your day if you ruin theirs, but they didn't blow their economy going to all this excess like both the U.S. and Russia did.
Which is a brilliant move.
I mean, you got to give it to the Chinese. They've been doing.
They're tacticians.
The Russians are your theoreticians with the elegant math. The Chinese are your tacticians, who know better than to interrupt you when you're making a mistake, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And we're the guys who go in with our broadswords.
You're right, and it's. Yeah, we go in screaming with red, white, and blue smoke flares hanging out of our ass, shooting off. We're just mag dumping into the sky, screaming for better or worse. The reason I brought up China wasn't just as my normal white American China. I just use as a scapegoat for everything that goes wrong. Because it got me thinking what you said. Mostly capitalist in Russia now, right? Mm-hmm. The Antonov Design Bureau. Antonov was one of the premier, if not the premier, aircraft designer in Soviet Union. Had his own office, had his own like vacation home, was very much catered to by the government because he was so good at what he did. And they created the Antonov 225, which carried the Buran. Which I didn't even think about as like a corollary, but that's not even what I was getting to. It was just the 225, that six engine monster. They built two, and then the Soviet Union collapsed, and they had nothing to do with it. And there's a great documentary that came out in like the early 2000s of these guys at the Antonov Design Bureau. And it's almost like they start like teenagers dabbling with like sex or alcohol. They start dabbling with capitalism. They're like, what if we, rent out plane to other like corporations, and they start making cash, and they're like, and you can literally see them in like real time, like learning capitalism. They're like, what if we use cash inflow to build up the 225? And they start projecting it, and they're like, let's build the 225. And they built it, and the 225 has been taking orders around the clock for the last like decade and a half. China is now ordering, I think, 10, because there's only one in the world. But that, the thing is, I'm getting to is the fall of the Soviets, less government care, and the Antonov, that's a very real world example that's happening right now. The Chinese military, the CCP, is ordering a fleet of these. So maybe the same thing happens with rocket engines.
Yeah. Well, I mean, SpaceX is definitely working on doing that on our end. Of course, they started out. Of course, you got to remember that hardly any of the companies that have been doing space have been as capitalist as SpaceX, even in the United States. They've all been basically sucking on the government tit, as far as they get a nice fat contract, yeah, and then it goes over 250%. Sorry, dudes, man, you don't pay it, then we're screwed.
Yeah.
No, SpaceX is like, no, we're going to make money. We're going to make money honestly. We're going to give you a better product for a lower price, and it's not going to blow up as much.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's
but again, the Chinese now they're starting to flex their muscles in space more. They're doing their moon mission, their little space station. But it's hard to tell how much of that is for our consumption and how much of it is just to keep the leaders happy. I mean, it's because they're very tight about their thing. I don't think they signed the Outer Space Treaty, so they're perfectly free to land on the moon and plant a flag there. Mm-hmm. Only more seriously than we did. They were not interested for a long time in manned space exploration because they probably saw it as a dick waving contest, and it was better to watch us waste our money on it. But now they're getting interested. But again, they're not doing the extravagance. It's more like they see that there are commercial applications, there are industrial applications for zero gravity, and the competition has kind of bowed out. So it's an opportunity for them to, but they wouldn't be doing it if they didn't see practical applications as well as the flag waving. Because if you look at it, even though they've done stuff they've never done before, they haven't really been as loud about it as either the U.S. or the Soviets were when we accomplished something big. Mm-hmm. Let's face it, Sputnik goes up, there's headlines all over the world. It's on the front page of the paper. China puts a rover on the moon, and it's on page 10.
I didn't even know China had put a rover on the moon. There you go.
Oh yeah, China put a rover on the moon. Little teeny thing, didn't last very long. They got something to learn, but
still, as someone as someone that considers myself somewhat well read, I didn't know.
Yeah, it was like the Tianji or something. Sure. It was named after one of their moon goddess.
Yeah,
but the you know, it was very similar to Pathfinder. It's a fixed lander that had this teeny little rover that would come out and run around and communicate mainly through its mothership. But you know, that way it could explore the immediate area. And it didn't last very long because they missed one of the environmental considerations. You know, doing the moon is surprisingly hard if you don't do it at lunar sunrise. All of the Apollo missions were conducted at the same time of lunar day.
Yep.
And you don't think about that because the moon turns so slowly. But that was a big advantage for thermal control, because you can get there when the ground is not stupidly cold or stupidly hot. Mm-hmm. Whereas a lander is in the same place mm-hmm. all day long. And a day is 2 weeks long, and it goes from, well, over the boiling point of water to liquid nitrogen. Back and forth. We found out about that from the surveyors. And before we had Apollo, we launched a couple of surface landers, and they sent back TV pictures until they failed. Mm-hmm. That's how we had some idea what the landscape looked like. Because you know, you remember in those days, it was widely conjectured that the moon dust would be so soft you would sink into it.
Yeah.
Things like that. Like
powdered snow. Yeah.
So we at least knew that it wasn't going to be like that. You know, we had surface landed a couple of things. And in fact, one of the things Apollo 12 did was they executed a precision landing and got close enough to one of the surveyors to walk to it and salvage parts to bring back to see how the lunar environment had affected them.
That's insane.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. There's some neat stuff that was done on the surface of the moon. There's a series of, there's a website that has the Apollo Surface Journal, which has all of the dialogue between mission control and the astronauts for all of the moon missions.
Okay.
So you can see what they did, and they have some of the pictures that were taken and all. And so, yeah, I was like, I hadn't realized until a couple of years ago that happened. But one of the problems with though was Apollo 12 brought a color camera. You know, because one of the things is on 11 was the pictures were crappy. But at the very first time they took the lens cap off the camera, they accidentally pointed it at the sun and burnt out the video tube.
That's what the government wants you to believe. Yeah.
So the pictures from Apollo 12 were still crappy.
Yeah. Yeah, I was gonna say.
And of course, Apollo 13 didn't make it. So you really forget whether Apollo. I think Apollo 14 was the first J mission that was able to stay for 5 days. You know, it's like 5 days instead of two or something. I mean, it was like they had the. Was it 14 or 15? They introduced the lunar rover, and they were able to do a lot more.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, all they were concerned about on 11 was getting there, planting the flag, walking around a bit, leaving the ALSEPS modules, and then getting the hell out. And on 12, they did salvage the surveyor camera, that's really cool, because there's pictures of the Apollo 12 astronaut taken by the other astronaut trying to break shit off of this spaceship that we had sent up 2 years ago and all. And people who weren't alive to read the accounts didn't even know about it. In fact, I was young enough that I had missed that, and so I didn't realize that they had done that until I went back and started researching it. It was some years ago now, but it was like, I lived through this. I should have seen this. Like, I didn't know that they did that. I did know the story about the precision landing. The mission director was extremely pissed that they spent some time trying to figure out where the hell 11 had landed, because they overshot their intended landing site. And of course, the moon's gravitational field isn't consistent. There are large masses called mascons under the surface, so your orbit isn't stable. And they ended up on the surface, but they were uncertain to, you know, like within tens of miles where they were. And the mission director was just like, I don't care what you have to do. I want a precision landing next time.
Yeah.
And in order to do it, they had to come up with this creative, because the computer programs in the lander and the command module, they couldn't change those. It was an enormous effort had gone into making those computers work at all. So they came up with a creative way of manipulating one of the variables, one of what they call the nouns, in order to fake out the program so that it would not return an accurate result, but would return the result that they needed in order to get where they knew they needed to be when they knew that they weren't where they were supposed to be at that point.
And I'm too stupid for that, Roger.
Yeah. I think that the girls that that movie was about had something to do with that stuff.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
The
actual computer. That's what the people were called back then, were computers.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, hidden figures.
Yeah.
This is a point where the fact is, so I didn't review this stuff the way that I reviewed some of the other stuff before our podcast. So I'm getting into areas where my inability to remember names is, you know, let me tell you, when you hit 40, you can feel the neurons starting to die.
Oh, it's like, God.
I knew this. I know this. I saw this movie. Why can't I remember its name?
It's that feeling when you're like really.
It's like, and it's all kinds of people say, oh, no, that's normal. That happens to everybody.
It's that feeling when you get hungover and you're like,
yeah,
have you ever seen that meme? And it's Superman as someone's like, as like he's removed from like the proximity of Krypton. And the meme is like, it's one of the old like original drawings of him, like the 50s, but he's like, my powers, they're coming back. But me and my friends always used to use that meme in college when it'd be like, we'd get super fucked up. And then the next day was a game day. We'd have hair of the dog and we'd start drinking whiskey and it'd be like, my powers are coming back and be like, I can talk. I'm gonna take a shower. My appetite's back. Like, really, it was just, you know, blossoming alcoholism. But it was, that's all I was gonna say. Yeah, we did go to the moon. Episode 216, Charlie Duke on this podcast went to the moon, which I still can't wrap my head around.
And he had one of the J missions, so he was on the moon for a while and did a lot of stuff.
Yeah, he was. So, yeah, he was on 16, was the backup for 13 and 17, was Capcom for 11. He was all in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've had people comment. I've been meaning to address this. Yeah, I've had people like comment or email or text me like, why were you like? Because if you go back and watch the episode with Charlie Duke, I'm like smiling and like snickering the entire time. It's because I'm talking to a guy that walked on the moon. Yeah. I just can't help. I'm giddy. I'm just like, doesn't matter what he says. I'm like this guy walked on the moon. So yeah, for anyone that's
it's like, this is one of my heroes who did something that I dream of, and he's giving me the time of day.
I know, right? He's talking to me. He said Tommy, and I'm like, holy shit, you're alive. You're not a deep fake. You're not. He's one of 12. Almost four times as many men have been the president. Almost 23 times as many men have been the Pope. All right.
Yeah. It's probably going to stay that way for a while. I mean, actually, it's starting to look iffy whether, you know, how long of a period there'll be where none of them are alive, and there won't be anyone alive who walked on the moon anymore.
It's true. There's only four right now: Harrison Schmitt, David Scott. Is it David Scott or Eric Scott? Charlie Duke and Buzz Aldrin. Yeah, it's
and they're all way up there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Buzz is like 90 something. Mr. Duke is, I believe, 87. Yeah, it's no. I mean, but you wouldn't know it. You wouldn't know it talking to Charlie Duke.
They were all like super healthy guys.
Yeah, yeah. You know, they have the right stuff. They still do.
Yeah. So. Yeah, but yeah, he was great.
Yeah, he was. That was.
I forget which one of the astronauts it was who figured out that human time on the moon cost about $1 million a minute.
Jesus.
When you looked at the cost of the whole program and the number of hours that human beings, the number of man hours that were spent on the moon,
yeah,
So it's kind of a responsibility that you have to take seriously.
Yeah. One thing I never thought about is that he said in one of his interviews, he was like that your suit doesn't move when you move. Like when you turn your head, it doesn't, you know, it's mm-hmm. just, he goes, when you look up, you didn't see the earth. You just saw the top of your helmet. And he said it wasn't yeah. until he fell over backwards that he saw the earth and was just like, oh my God. But yeah, it's, yeah, that's one thing that I don't know why it's one aspect that always, of all the, you know, just the general, it's the moon. One thing that always gets me is like, they stayed there. Like they slept there. Like they woke up, mm-hmm. they yawned, they, you know.
Well, they were supposed to sleep there. If you read the interview, some of them didn't actually get much sleep while they were on the moon.
How do you? Just like, you just, you know, oh, I'm on the fucking moon. Like,
yeah.
Have you ever seen the Onion video, or you know the news site, or the satirical news site, The Onion?
Yeah, I've seen some of their have you seen articles,
their original moon articles that came out in like the late 90s.
No.
And it's like the actual transcript, and it's like Tranquility Base here. Holy fucking shit, we are on the fucking moon. I can't. This is one small. Oh my! I'm on the fucking moon. Buzz, look at me. I'm on the fucking moon. And you hear like Tranquility Base. We got you. This is fucking insane. Like it's just like I can't. Holy tit balls. I can't believe it.
Now that you're doing that, I think I do remember seeing that one.
Yeah.
But it's like, what is that like? But
yeah.
On the other hand, you're also 250,000 miles from anybody else, so it's a little danger there.
It's, I didn't ask him out of like respect, because I don't want my dumb ass to go into like conspiracies, but I want him to be like, is there anything up there? Is there anything? Is there like an old, like, is there like ruins? Is there something? But
yes, I saw that Transformers movie too.
Yes. Fuck you, Roger. So help me God, I will ban you from this podcast. But if that or 2001 A Space Odyssey, it took every ounce of willpower I had. I decided the morning of, I was like, I will not waste a second of this man's time with conspiracy questions.
It's kind of the respectful thing to do.
That's, yeah. I was like, it's...
Besides, you know, those guys get that shit more than they want to anyway.
Yes.
But you did have the advantage that he couldn't do like Buzz Aldrin and punch you through the computer, so...
I think Charlie Duke would have no problem finding me and beating the shit out of me.
He would come, I'm gonna come get you.
Buzz Aldrin.
I've been on the moon. You're not a problem.
I can get there. I can get to you. Yeah.
Hey, I think all of these guys flew most of them flew fighter jets.
All from the Air Force, like that, yeah. Too. All from the Air Force, yeah. It's, yeah.
Well, one of the guys on 17 was actually a geologist. I forget what, I don't remember any of their names off the top of my head.
Neither can I. Well, Charlie Duke was 16, never mind.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things when they shortened the program and they were rearranging the crew schedules around, is they wanted to get an actual scientist onto the moon. So that was their chance. They got the geologist who they had been training onto 17 before mm-hmm. the program ended. And that apparently worked out real well, too.
Yeah. Do you think, not just time for some wild speculation based on nothing, do you think we're going to see manned Mars in our lifetime?
Lifetime is possible, but in the near future, probably not. And the main reason is we don't know how to land there. We don't even know approximately how to land there. And, you know, so I think that is a problem that is probably going to take longer to solve than some people want to admit. Because the problem with Mars is it has just enough atmosphere to fuck your shit up, but not enough to actually stop you before you hit the ground. Yeah. So you can't just easily do a direct landing like you do on the moon, because there's too much atmosphere and it'll burn you up before you lose enough velocity. So you've kind of got to use parachutes. But no matter how big you make the parachutes, they're not going to stop you before you hit the ground. So you still have to do a direct landing at the end, which is kind of the thing Curiosity even has to do. And Curiosity is only the size of a golf cart. You know, the whole little airbag thing don't work for things that weigh too much, and they don't work for human beings. The problem is, if you look at the size of a capsule that you need to put a viable crew on the surface, even if you put all the rest of the equipment by some other method, then putting 4 or 5 human beings on the surface of Mars in one operation, we have no clue how to land something that heavy on that planet without taking enough, so much fuel along that it would be just ridiculous. I think the way that the theoretical thing was done in The Martian is that the high thrust fuel was shipped there in the high impulse, low thrust ship. So the big ship, they only had one of it, and it did the shuttle service back and forth. But the, you know, while it was in the vicinity of Earth, they would ship fuel up to it that for the higher thrust engines that could be used to drop to the surface and reascend. Now, I know a part of Musk's plan is to make fuel for the ascent using sunlight and raw materials and whatever, which is time consuming. But if you land your ascent stage early on and let it sit on the surface for a few years making fuel, then you know, you may have your base materials there and fuel to get back to the high impulse, low thrust ship that can take you home. But all of this is, I mean, you think about how long it took us to build the ISS, and the ISS would not be adequate for a ship to take you to Mars.
It wouldn't?
No. God, because trying to do it without at least some artificial gravity section or simulated gravity apparatus to exercise in, you're not talking about the longest anyone has stayed on the ISS now is, you know, what, in the vicinity of a year?
Mm-hmm. About.
A practical Mars mission is going to take a minimum of 2, and it can't be resupplied. So if you look at that, and the frequency with which things break means that you have to have parts because you can't be resupplied. You can't call home and say, oh, the dupimeter broke, we need another one, and we'll put that on the next SpaceX capsule, because it isn't going to be a next SpaceX capsule till you get home.
Yeah.
So it's a completely different thing. So when you look at the effort it took us to build the ISS and look at the ship in The Martian, which I think is a realistic depiction of something that could actually work. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's the guy is good at who wrote it, you know. But I don't think we're going to be in a position to build something like that within the next 10 years.
God damn it.
And without something like that, it's kind of hard to imagine any kind of humans on Mars scenario. So now you could do, you know, of course, a lot of people are disappointed that the Apollo mission was done in such a way that it didn't result in a long-term presence on the moon. It didn't lay the groundwork, which, of course, all of the pioneers, including von Braun, were thinking that would be your first step into deep space and you would use it to build a base. And instead, we did this lunar orbit rendezvous thing where you basically take the rocket apart as you're going and coming back until you basically land on a skateboard.
Yeah.
And
just stripping as you go.
Yeah.
You just stripping.
And that was what made the mission possible in the time frame that it was done in, though.
Yeah.
If they had taken, you know, von Braun's approach was that you would land a team of 30 or 40 people and have several ships, some that would just be the supplies that they would use to build a base and everything. And that would have been better for the long term, but it wouldn't have happened in the time frame that it did, and the money to do it didn't exist. I don't think there was that much political will into the concept of beating the Russians to the moon.
Yeah.
So instead of sending a proper, well, basically, instead of mounting a colonization attempt, we mounted a cursory exploration.
Yeah.
So this wasn't the Mayflower. This was Lewis and Clark.
This was the showpiece. This was get there with the flag, get the picture.
Yeah. Well, and also the exploration. We learned a lot more than people realize from the lunar missions, and we didn't learn a lot of it until the data that were collected were analyzed with more modern instruments and you know, computers and detectors for the rock samples and all. But without the Apollo missions, we probably would not know that, as we are pretty sure now, that the moon was created in a giant collision.
Mm-hmm.
By a Mars-sized body with the proto-Earth that knocked all this material into orbit, which coalesced to form the moon. But because we went there and because we collected enough samples and also things like the orbital gravity signature and stuff, you know, we really didn't know anything about the place before we visited, and we suddenly knew quite a bit more. I remember one of the astronauts who was not one of the ones who stayed on the moon. He was one of the ones who stayed in the capsule in orbit.
Yeah.
And they had an instrument that was doing a radar survey or something. But he noticed it was actually, there was several instruments collecting different readings, and they were printing, of course, everything at that time was printing on graph, you know, the little rolling graphs, right? And he saw that these two instruments were drawing the same curve as, you know, they were measuring completely different things.
Okay.
And I forget the details of it, but he said in that moment he knew the moon had once been molten.
Okay.
Because that was the only way to explain
correlating that
these two completely different physical properties were
arcing in the same way.
Slave to, you know, were ganged to one another.
Yeah.
So there's a lot. People don't realize how much we learned about going to space, doing material science, the computers and electronics, as well as little details like where the moon came from. I mean, you know, I think it is worth knowing things like that.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I had a book about the solar system, and it was all artist's impressions. That was all there was. No human-built machine had ever been to the surface of another planet.
Fuck. Yeah.
And, you know, with Apollo, we sent the surveyors. The Russians sent a rover. In fact, I think they sent a couple of rovers, which were pretty successful. They had their guys who normally design tanks for warfare design their lunar rovers.
Gotta love it.
That's the Russians. So you had that little flurry of unmanned activity, and then we followed it up by actually going there with, you know, human eyes and cameras and stuff. So all of a sudden the moon was a real place with a surface. But our best pictures of the other planets were still from outer space. You know, we had done, at that time, I think we had already done a couple of flybys of Mars that were halfway decent. We knew shit about the outer solar system. I don't think we had done Mercury yet. The Soviets did Venus.
Yeah. Viking. Was it Viking?
Venera. No. Viking was our Mars lander.
Yeah.
Venera was the Soviets' Venus landers.
Yeah.
And they managed to last, like, you know, 2 hours on the surface of Venus before the heat got them.
I mean, if that is not the best, like, example of, like, this, like, Soviet meme. Like, be strong. Like...
Well, it was actually, when you look at how hostile the surface of Venus is, that they got anything that they got data from.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, that they got data from the surface of Venus is pretty badass, because every time we tried, it fried.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The atmospheres, the temperature, the rain, you know, the sulfuric acid rain, that little part. It's
now it was the other way around with Mars. The Soviets. Non-landing space missions to Mars all flopped dismally. I know they did one that got there before our big orbiting, our first really successful orbiter, which I don't remember which one it was. But I know the Soviets had a mission, but it was all pre-programmed.
Mm-hmm.
And as the spacecraft was approaching Mars, a huge dust storm enveloped the planet. And they couldn't alter the mission profile because it had been pre-programmed into the orbiter. And so they got all of these beautifully detailed pictures of dust flying around in the atmosphere. They got like no information about the surface. When we got there, there was a similar thing, but because dust storms happen on Mars all the time. But we were able to extend the mission and, you know, change the profile so that we could wait out the storm. And that was the thing is, it's like we had the bad luck in Venus and Russia had the bad luck with Mars. And then, of course, we hit it out of the park in the outer solar system with the Vikings.
Yeah. And the Voyager.
And so, but the Voyagers, rather.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was like one at a time we've actually gotten something to the surface of these worlds, are close enough from orbit for a world like Mercury that we can tell, okay, we can pretty much tell what this is going to be like if you were down there. So that this entire book that was nothing but drawings that I had when I was like 5 years old, so it would have been maybe 69, mm-hmm. One at a time, they became photographs. Instead of being speculation, it became fact,
yeah,
about these worlds,
yeah,
until the last toll was Pluto, and New Horizons fixed that. That was the last world whose surface we had not seen in detail. And you know, it's almost hard to remember that in my lifetime there was a time when we hadn't seen the surface of any of the solar system's worlds any better than you can see it through a telescope from your backyard.
Yeah, that's kind of like, that shows how much we're still like in the cradle, right? That shows how much we're still as a species in the cradle, like barely taking first steps.
Yeah, well, it's the right now we're at the point where, yeah, we're driving radio control cars around on Mars, as one of your guests did, and doing the closer examinations. I think the next big thing is probably going to be investigating one of the ocean worlds,
yeah,
to see if there's any sign of life there. And actually, our best candidate for that is suddenly starting to look like Ceres, mm-hmm, the asteroid.
Because
it's both closer and it was just a lot easier to get to. And it's starting to look like it has a huge under ice ocean. So,
well, we've got the one going to Mars right now that has a helicopter on it.
Yeah, that's it's also a rover. Now the helicopter on this one isn't going to actually do very much. It's going to drop. The rover's going to drive a little way out from it, and it's going to pick up, and they're just going to do basically a short experimental flight. It's not going to get very high off the ground or go very far. It's more to prove the concept that they can get a flying machine onto the surface and fly it around. But it's not going to have like an extended mission where it gets recharged again,
yeah,
and goes along with the rover on. You know, it's the rover's going to leave it.
Yeah,
it's just going to be space junk on the surface of Mars.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, what's the thing that's always compared is, yeah, 67 years between the Wright Flyer and Saturn V. I mean, you got to start somewhere. So it's going to start with a little,
yeah,
you know, just flying around. Like,
yeah.
It's going to start with that, and then it's going to be, hey, it was only, yeah, 67 years between X, yeah, and Y.
Well, and if you look at what they've done in the past, though, if you look at Pathfinder,
yeah,
where the rover was a similar little throwaway experiment that just happened to over, you know, it did a lot better than they expected, but proved what was possible. So they moved from that to landing actual rovers that were decent science labs that were the primary mission, instead, yeah, of having the primary mission being a static lander with the rover as an afterthought. So I think that's what you'll see, is that now that they know that they can make it work, then they're already thinking about how we do a mission that uses flight in a more primary way, mm-hmm, to gather more data. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be like the difference between the original and the J missions that had the lunar rover on the moon. Because, you know, when you're limited by how far you can walk in a spacesuit,
yeah,
before you're, with a safety margin to make sure that your life support doesn't run out, versus how far you can drive in a car that can go 8 miles an hour, then all of a sudden you're able to cover a lot more ground.
Yeah.
And by careful selection of their destinations on the moon, they were able to get a really wide amount of geological data.
Sorry, hold on. Moving a hard drive. Yeah. 1 second. I want to show you something. You cool if we wrap this one up in like 5 minutes?
Sure, whatever you want.
Hold on. I got this one in the mail. Newest edition, 16 terabytes. It's the same price as the one I got for 10 terabytes this time last year. Yeah, just kind of on the happens. Note of the last episode was just general progression. Is this podcast sponsored by Seagate, including all of the insane, misogynistic, inappropriate things I say. Thanks, Seagate. I expect my cease and desist from them, but yeah.
So, okay. So, yes, at space, we've... Yeah. That's where we are right now.
Yeah. Sorry for throwing that on your dish last night. Of like, hey, are we doing Baran? And you were like, oh, touch up. I was like, fuck. I apologize. I shouldn't have thrown that.
No, that's not a problem. I got the Wikipedia too, so I can, it's mainly reminding myself the names of things. Yeah. Because I do know a lot of this stuff off the top of my head, but what I don't know is people's names. I've always had a mental block about that. So it's like the names of the programs, the names of the engines and all. So I just went back and was like, oh, yeah, that was what that was called.
Yeah.
And it's easy for me to find because I do know what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
It wasn't a big deal at all. I was, you said you wanted to talk about Baran. So I was like, okay, yeah, I can go back and be familiarized. But you can see when I get off the reservation and like that movie that I saw, it's like that I saw like 6 months ago.
Yeah.
Won however many Academy Awards and all that, but I can program a computer, man. So
also more than anything, I always appreciate your episodes, dude, because it's a free. I get like a 60 minute documentary every week, and it's interactive. I get to ask questions, and it's like I appreciate it. I legitimately do. I legitimately fucking look forward to our meetings every week. I just get a science lesson.
Well, it's fun for me too because sometimes you lose perspective on just how much you've experienced and gone through, and so it's kind of fun for me to go back and review. Yeah. And it's like, damn, I remember doing that.
You have an insane amount of knowledge. You do.
Yeah. Well, I've had a very interesting job, as well as some people thinking I'm pretty talented. My connection with our space shuttle is when I was 17. I have something in common with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I won a major prize at the International Science Fair.
Really?
Yeah. So, she did too. But I won a third award in physics. There's 10 categories, physics, math, biology, blah, blah, blah. So I won a third award in physics for putting a radioactive source on top of the memory chips in my computer and extrapolating the cosmic rays were probably not causing the soft errors that were sometimes being seen then, because I didn't see any soft errors when I was using my dad's radioactive source to duke my RAM chips. And what they liked about it particularly was that I recognized that a negative result was valuable. I expected this to create errors mm-hmm. that I would detect, and I didn't. And because I was basically nuking these chips with a form of radiation that silicon is more sensitive to than it is to cosmic rays, and with a lot more of it than you have in the cosmic ray flux, where I was able to say, the rate that they say these things are happening, this can't be explained. You would have like one every 400 years. So they gave me, I got the general third award, which was a nice little cash thing and a medal. But there is a bunch of other awards that are given by different third parties. Like each branch of the military gives one. And I got the Air Force's first award because I guess my thing on computer errors and radiation was more interesting to them than the guy who did violins and the other one who did some crystallography thing. So the prize was a 10-day tour of Air Force installations all around the country.
That's badass.
It was. We got to meet the Secretary of the Air Force.
It was
Vern Orr under Ronald Reagan. They took us to the Pentagon. We drove past the mall. We flew into Washington, into Andrews AFB, drove straight to the Pentagon, met the Secretary of the Air Force. He asked us each what our project was and everything. Then we got back in the car, drove back to the Air Force base and flew out. Didn't stop at the mall. Didn't see anything else in Washington, D.C. But we got to walk around on top of the EMP trestle.
Jesus.
flew in. One of the planes we flew in was a radar trainer. So we all had our own private little radar set to play with.
That's badass.
But anyway, they kept telling us, we got a real treat planned for you when we get to Florida. We're not sure if we're going to be able to do it. We're still negotiating because of the security arrangements. But they pulled it off. And when we visited Kennedy, we got to walk around underneath the shuttle orbiter Columbia while they were refitting it between its first and second missions in space.
Jesus.
And so there's all these guys walking around with machine guns and shit to protect everything. The security was insane. But
Jesus.
And this was when they had the tile thing. So it's like every one of those fucking tiles had a little label on it.
Oh, yeah.
Some were red and some were yellow and all. And it's like these guys on ladders doing tests and shit. But it was just nuts. The thing is fucking huge.
The space shuttle?
I wrote in one of my descriptions of that, this thing that looks like a lawn dart on top of a Pringles can, when you're actually standing under it, looks like the roof of an auditorium or something.
Jesus.
It just goes forever.
Jesus.
So that was like when the Columbia was destroyed.
Mm-hmm. 2003.
That was a very kind of a personal thing for me.
Well, that's what I was thinking. It's like, okay, wow. I vividly remember that morning. I was like in seventh grade or something. Yeah.
Yeah. I was actually in Natchitoches, Texas, where some of the debris fell.
Yeah.
Just a week before the disaster. In fact, I was in the hotel room watching the NASA coverage, like the live NASA TV on the cable, of the mission, before I drove home. And
yeah, that.
It was less than a week. It was just a few days after I got home. Then the news is that the shuttle was destroyed. And I was like, wait a minute. And a lot of the debris fell on the town that I was staying in there.
That's weird.
It's
a weird woo, right?
Yeah. I actually wrote an article about it for Corrosion called Bookends in Time. And, you know, it was very weird because it's like I was personally there near the beginning of its life, and I was personally there near the end of its life.
That's very weird. Yeah, that's I felt that way about not nearly as majestic. Yours is about a beautiful spacecraft. Mine's about the comedian Bill Hicks. But I discovered him, you know, his most famous quote, right? Today, a young man on acid realized that we're all one, you know, that whole thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I discovered that while at school in Valdosta, Georgia. And I was like, this is brilliant. And like found out like William Hicks, like born in Valdosta, Georgia. I was like, oh my God, that's awesome. I need to go see this like comedian, not knowing that he had been dead for like 17 years at that point. And I was like, oh, fuck. But he died near where I lived in Arkansas when I was little.
Wow.
I was like, that's a little weird, but you know. Maybe that's just me trying to associate my own mediocrity with someone who's brilliant. I was like, technically, we're the same, right? Because I visited two similar. He was regarded as like top three comics of all time. I mean, you know, we're the same, right? It's, you know, you smudge the math. I am Bill Hicks. Like, let's just call it what it is. I'm Bill Hicks. I'm better than Bill Hicks. It's
don't know about better, but
no, yeah. I'm not even need no, don't even yeah. yeah no I'm not anywhere no goddamn Bill Hicks is a yeah. Bill, I had the unfortunate unpopular position of I supported the war, but it was against the troops. Only fucking Bill Hicks can say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They George Bush and the boys were going wild in Desert Storm. Like, pull it up, Donnie. What's that? Weapon D4. What's that do? Says it destroys everything but the fillings in their teeth. Let it off. Cool. What's next? D15. What's that one do? Those boys were in hog heaven. Yeah, he's got some great Desert Storm bits. He's like, a war is between two enemies. Not 800 casualties, 800,000 versus 59. Because that means we could have sent 60, and there'd be one guy coming back going, woo! And it's like, you got to remember, this is like in like 94. Like, he's doing this, and it's like, only he could pull it off, right?
Yeah, you've got a few comedians like that whose shit would anybody else would be dead if they tried it.
Sam Kinison. I mean,
Rodney Dangerfield's whole respect thing. Yeah. No one else could pull that off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about Sam Kinison's the.
Yeah.
Yeah. For a dollar, you could feed these kids. Well, why don't you just move them? Why do you live there? Why do you live in the fucking desert? But he goes, how about instead of giving them money for a sandwich, because then they're just going to keep, they're going to stay there. It's going to be like animals that they tell you not to feed. How about we put all our money, we get a long convoy of UN U-Hauls, or do one trip. We go out there, get your shit, get your favorite rock or piece of sand or whatever the fuck you have, bring them to LA, and it's over. You know, for $1 a day, you could give these kids a sandwich. And he's like, you know, the director's like, don't give him the sandwich yet. We got to get the shot. Get the hunger in his eyes. You don't get it right now. Holy fuck. He goes, good. You're going to stay out there in the desert. You deserve this. And it's like, holy fuck.
Yeah. Well, I mean, things like that work because there's a kernel of truth in them, too. So
that's how they all work, is the. That's what Eminem said, you know, back when he was becoming Marshall Mathers, is he was like, you can't just make lyrics just to offend, because anyone could say, fuck, cunt, asshole, you know, whatever, burning crucifix. Anyone can say the buzzwords. He's like, you gotta say something that someone deep down goes, I don't like that.
Yeah, you gotta have meaning behind them.
You gotta prick it somewhere. Yeah, it's. And I was two more quick ones of just pirating people's material. That's not mine. Sam Kinison. Sorry I'm late, everybody. Thanks for coming out to the show. But, you know, I'm sorry I'm late. I spent 15 minutes at 7-Eleven trying to buy cigarettes going, Marlboro! Marlboro! Smokey, Smokey! He goes, this motherfucker from Vietnam couldn't speak English. And he goes, I should have killed you in Da Nang when I had the chance. And then another one that you couldn't get, George Carlin, is like, we sure can make bombs. We love bombing brown people. United States, we can't build a microwave or a VCR. But if you have brown people, you better tell them to watch out, because we're going to bomb them. He goes, we don't bomb white people. When's the last time we bombed white people? Have we ever bombed white people? One time, the Germans. And that's only because they were trying to take over the world. Bullshit. That's our fucking job. Oh, bullshit. That's our fucking job. They're trying to cut in on the action. And we were like, blonde hair, blue eyes, we'll bomb them. You don't touch our money.
Now you know what's really important.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's like a less eloquent way of like Voltaire saying, to know who rules you, find out who you can't criticize, right? Mm-hmm. Is the only time we'll bomb white people is when white people are trying to get in on our military industrial action, trying to take over the world. Bullshit. That's our fucking job. But before I just keep going, shamelessly tearing off other people's material and repackaging it as my own podcast, let's wrap this bitch up. Robert, not Robert. God, Jesus Christ, I need some sleep. Roger.
If I had a nickel for every time someone has done that, I could have retired.
Really? I found a nickel at work the other day in 1940. That's not relevant. I have not slept well the last two nights. What's in your Rolodex of your mind, what's our episode next week? You don't have to answer right now. I don't know why I'm putting you on the spot.
I don't know. It's it's your show, man. So what interests you?
No, I What I'm interested in, I love when people are passionate about stuff. Like, I had on my buddy from work, Forrest, with the Magic the Gathering. I had on Vinny talk about wines.
Yeah.
Those aren't things that I'm necessarily interested in. What I'm interested, I love when I'm interested in people who are interested in something. It's their interest that kind of ignites me. You and I just so happen to, our Venn diagram overlaps a little more because we have a lot of the same interests. But in general, what I like is just, I just like the passion, regardless of what it is.
Yeah, well, how about the scale of the universe? How we learned how big the universe is?
Fucking done. Let's do it. Let's do it.
Because we only learned a lot of that in the recent past, too. So there's been a lot of stuff that has been discovered in the last decade or so.
Really?
That is sharp. I mean, we've gone from, we think it's between 10 and 20 billion light years to the Hubble limit to 13.6 billion. And we know a lot more about stuff that's out there. And we've seen, the ways that, certain particular observations have verified certain key assumptions that mm-hmm. used to just be, well, we think this is that, and now we can say, well, we know.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, no need to get into the big preview. Then we'll do cosmology.
Fuck yes, I fucking love it. I love it. I get it. Regardless of the podcast, even if the podcast didn't exist, I would just lie to you and I would just keep doing weekly. Just I get a free 90-minute lesson.
Even though you're not sending me the links anymore, I still know where to find your podcast. Well, so I know whether you're putting my episodes up.
Well, I stopped sending you the links because I figured you figured it out. I figured after like the second time I did that, at some point you would start to take it as insulting. Like, here you go, Roger. Like, do you know how to use YouTube? Like, at a certain point, I figured it would be insulting.
I know how to put the letters TP and C into the search function in the YouTube app.
Oh, yeah. No, you really got to find it because it's way too small. They're like, Tommy's podcast. They're like, fuck off. No, we got Joe Rogan. We have Kanye. That's it. Nothing in between. But yeah, I'll keep sending you the links, Roger, if that's a shot across the bow.
I didn't figure it out.
No, it's war. It's war. I take that as a personal affront. And it's just like Charlie Duke can find me. I'm going to find you, motherfucker.
Yeah, but I'll jujitsu it because then all I have to do is hit forward to send it to my dad instead of having to copy it out of the URL bar and paste it into a new email.
Okay. You lazy fuck. That's the limit.
Have you ever read the Robert Heinlein essay In Praise of the Lazy Man?
Mm-mm.
Heinlein wrote this whole short story length essay in one of his anthologies about how all of human progress is down to the people who are lazy.
Well, yeah, that's Bill Gates, right? The hire the laziest man for the job because he'll find the most efficient way to do it.
Yeah, well, Gates got that from Heinlein.
Yeah. Imagine. So yeah,
it was considered quite shocking when Heinlein did it, but that's also true of a lot of the things Heinlein wrote. He goes through like example after example of some lazy asshole who didn't want to be. It's like one of the first was the original Newcomen steam engines were operated by hand,
mm-hmm.
and so they would hire a boy to sit there and turn the valves to make the cylinder go up and down, to inject the steam, and then when the cylinder get to the top to spray the water so that the cylinder would go back down. Well, at some point, one of these kids figured out how to hook everything up with a bunch of ropes so that the cylinder would operate the valves himself.
Yeah.
And then, all of a sudden you start seeing these machines that have automatic linkages. And it's like, who thought of that? It was, the engineers building them didn't care. I hired some kid, but it was one of the kids that figured it out.
I mean, I would,
of course, he also put himself out of a job.
Yeah, that's the other thing is he didn't lawyer up, That's what you get. That's what you get for growing up then. But, yeah, I mean, I think that's a very fair argument. Because, I mean, at the very core, you have to look at why did we go from nomads to agriculture. At the very beginning, it's like, we won't be able to have food every day, but what if we just bust our balls for, like, 1 year, plant all this shit, and then food just grows out of the fucking ground and we can kick it. It's just, instead of just constantly every day we're going to hunt,
yeah,
put it all right here, build a hut.
Yeah,
Game over.
That could be another topic sometime about how agriculture arose, because that's of interest. In fact, I have a little running thing in the series that I just concluded on Reddit, The Curators. On the third of the four books is from the viewpoint of the curator human agent who has been on Earth for 100,000 years, and each episode starts with a little vignette from his past. So he actually traces his observation of humans, and so that comes from my general understanding of where agriculture came from, where technology came from. So it's like this alien who is effectively immortal, living among humans, observing us. And of course, the whole shtick in that story is that the curators didn't curate us because they thought we were not success material, that we were too violent.
Yeah.
You know, we were eventually going to kill each other anyway, and so it wasn't worth it. And he's noticing that we keep not killing each other, even after we do these crazier and crazier things. And he's like, you know, there's like six of them on the Earth, and every once in a while they communicate, and they're like, you know, we're trying to tell the guys out in the galaxy that this is a race that is doing some pretty incredible things. And it's like, yeah, what they're doing, they're enslaving their neighbors and, you know, shit like that. And they're like, yeah, but they're enslaving their neighbors because we didn't give them an economy of plenty with the nanites. And so the only way they can get this shit is to force their neighbors to help them make it.
Yeah, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy type thing, right?
Yeah. And so the ones that are on Earth are seeing that this is like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And that, you know, of course, the theme of the group that I posted all this in is humanity. Fuck yeah. The stories are supposed to be about human exceptionalism, how great humans are. So I decided that it would be how humans managed to overcome this and do better shit than anybody else was doing because we had to do it ourselves. And so, you know, in this set of chapters, we're having the recollections of how he observed that, yeah, these guys, you know, on the one hand, they're enslaving all of their neighbors, but on the other hand, they just built this network of roads to get to their neighbors that's unlike anything else in the galaxy. And, you know, this was the Romans.
Yeah.
And they're like, nobody else does this. And it's because they don't have to.
Okay.
And so that's sort of a background trace of that development. So it's like when I was writing that, I went back and reviewed a few things. One of the funnier things I did is I had him be Joseph from the Bible. He advises the king who thinks he's enslaved, a scribe who's a slave. Of course, you know, he can just think about it and disappear, so he's not really anybody's slave, but being in this position lets him observe well. And so this is a civilization. It's not, it's actually the Mesopotamians. It's not the, you know, the Hebrews or the Egyptians, but so he's in a situation where they've just developed agriculture and they're burning out the land, and he can see that they're burning out the land and they just keep expanding. And but they now have a surplus, which they've never had before. And so the young king is asking for his advice on, you know, conquering their neighbors and expanding his domain. And he's like, maybe you should, you know, build a stockpile of food now that we're able to do that, you know, just in case there's a lean time, you know, maybe wait 3 years or five or even 7 years. And when I was telling that story to my wife, I got to five and she said, or seven.
Yeah.
So it's like, and so he just, you know, caps that off with, and so that was the first time I showed up in the Christian Bible.
Yeah. That's actually, can I opt for that episode and we'll do cosmology after? Because now I'm hooked on, now I'm hooked on that. Is, I love that idea of they're doing shit that no one else, right? It's almost, there's almost some like meta, like this is the Soviets with the RD-180. Mm-hmm. Right, because they just can't throw the plenty at it, the metaphorical nanites. Yeah.
So really that's what's driven human progress. I've long ago I read a theory, I forget exactly where I saw it put exactly this way, that civilization arose in Europe because it was not too hard in that climate, but it was also not easy enough without it. So there was a tension between having everything you want without doing too much work. Hunter-gatherers, particularly those who live in relatively benign climates, tend not to work very much. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've done studies that show they work like 20 hours a week securing, you know.
If you're in paradise, and, yeah.
Yeah, so why would you do this? So, if you live in Polynesia or Central Africa before we turned it into a desert, then you're not going to do all this complicated shit. But in Europe, you've got a nice fertile season followed by a nasty winter.
Yeah.
Every year.
It's going to kill you if you don't step
So it pays to develop agricultural techniques and stockpiles and all this stuff. And it's just the right time. But it's not so hard that it just crushes you. Because, you know, the Eskimos also aren't going to come up with high technology because they simply don't have the resources.
It's just because it's just too hard.
Right. So you've got this place where it was in just sort of in the middle. And it was also kind of that way in China. But then there were more social reasons why they rose to a certain level and then didn't go past it because they didn't have to for other reasons. Whereas in Europe, you also had the rivalries and you didn't turn it into an empire. It was a little too easy for the Chinese to turn it into an empire and then sit back and enjoy that.
Isolationism, yeah.
In Europe, you also had enemies who wanted what you had. So there's just perfect storm of influences.
For ingenuity.
That drove it to ridiculous extremes. And of course, one of Andrew's monologues in the story was, after the Roman Empire fell, the guys out in the galaxy were telling us, yeah, we told you so, you know, they're going to all kill each other. It's like, it's a sure thing, you know, it's like, just let us know when it happens. And then then the Middle Ages come around and everyone starts building all this shit. And they're like, they realize how very, very wrong they were.
It's kind of like, have you ever seen, we're going to wrap it up. Because we're going to start jumping.
Yeah, this is going to be next week's episode.
Yeah, we'll jump, but just so I don't forget, because I will forget. I saw something where they took like a microbiological medium, you know, almost like a big petri dish, but it was in like the shape of the United States, and then they put the AGAR. They put the really good shit where the cities are, and then they put the psychedelic mushrooms, the cubensis. What is it? Yeah, is it cubensis? Whatever the ones are that make psilocybin, they put the spores in there, and they mapped their own connections to the cities, and then when they ran it against our like subway and highway connections, it was actually more efficient. And it was like, fuck. I think they tried it again in like Tokyo. And I think Tokyo, they actually did it, and it was like, of course the Japanese fucking figured out like the most, like the thermodynamically most efficient. Like, of course they fucking did. But yeah, it was like there are weird ways where if you create, like a hardcore, not enough that it kills you, but enough that it's challenging, like you will. That is natural selection. But we're gonna spoil next week. So let's wrap this one up. Roger, thank you so much as always. It's a pleasure. And Roger Williams, author of The Metamorphosis of Prime Intellect, which I plug every episode, will be in the comments, the top comment, and in the description. It's my favorite book. It's fucking fantastic. Just go get it. It's awesome. And man, thank you for doing it.
Hey, it's always a pleasure.
And I'll send you a link, Roger.
Send me the links.
Because you have just made a 20-minute argument of why it is important to be lazy. So you've convinced me, all right? You've convinced me. I'll send you the link. Because somehow that's going to lead to our galactic introduction. I hate you. All right, buddy. Stay safe. I'll see you next week.
Bye.
All right, big man. Peace.